Hey everybody, happy new year, almost. Welcome to F This Movie,
the podcast that survived the Mayan apocalypse.
It is the last day of 2012, and you have made a wise choice on closing out this year by listening to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm joined tonight for our annual discussion of the overrated, the underrated, and the ugly movies of 2012 by JB.
Hello. Starting next week, I will be selling, probably on the website, Mayan calendar addendum.
Nice. I like that. You can find our website at fthismovie.net. You can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/fthismovie. Follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/fthismovie. And email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. This show, which is now, this is the third time we've done this show.
Yes.
Sort of kicks off our year-end retrospective. A lot of other websites have already done it, so maybe we're late to the party. We planned it this way, everybody. So next week you can look forward to our Best of 2012 show.
That's going
to
be something. I'm bringing crack cocaine.
Nice. I thought you were going to say crackers for a second, and then you went a different way.
You know, I think that's a better idea. Some townhouse or some Ritz or some Triscuits, and maybe Doug can bring some cheese.
We do this show every year as sort of a warm-up to the Best of 2012, or we don't do the Best of 2012 every year. We do the year that's just passed,
no,
right?
I seem to remember in 2010, we made a massive mistake, and we did the Best of 2012, and the problem with that, excuse me, I'm chewing ice.
We thought the world was going to end.
No, we accidentally...
So I was like, my number nine, a giant cloud of dust. My number eight, locusts!
No, we accidentally revealed that one of our superpowers was the power of psychic precognition.
Yes.
So we were talking about all these 2012 movies, and it made our listeners, you know, scratch their heads. Argo? What is this Argo? So that was fun.
That was fun. Let's
we
just
are gods,
jump.
Worship us.
Let's just jump right into it. We're going to talk about our favorite underrated movies.
But first, a brief cautionary tale.
Oh, yes,
tale.
Sir. Always.
Months ago,
cautionary tale.
Months ago, and it might have been years ago, because I can't keep track anymore, Roger Ebert had detailed in his column, I think it might have been the column where people write asking questions.
Yes.
About the dimness of some movies in some theaters. And, of course, for years and years, Ebert had been writing about theaters that had turned down the intensity on the bulb, thinking it would make it last longer, which is hooey. That's, it's not true at all. But there was this new phenomenon that if you're in a theater where they're screening more than one movie in that theater a day, and one of the films is in 3D and the other film is in 2D, they will occasionally forget to remove the image separator. It's this box-like thing that they put in front of the projector for the 2D movie.
Okay.
And so they will be projecting it through this beam splitter, for lack of a better word, and it diminishes the brightness.
Okay.
So this afternoon, I am sitting through Flight, and in the back of my head, during the opening credits, I'm like, that's an awfully strange shade of gray for the opening title card, Flight. It would seem that that's supposed to be white on black, and I filed that away. And at the end of the movie, during the end credits, sure enough, I looked up at the projection booth, and there was an image on top of another image. They had forgotten to remove the beam splitter, or the image separator, or the image doubler, or whatever the hell they call it. And I actually pointed it out to the manager, or assistant manager, and she claimed that that wouldn't be what it was. Although, if I'm seeing the image above the image in the glass of the projection booth,
yeah,
that's the only thing it could be.
I would think.
And she said it might be that the bulb needs to be replaced. That, oh, that's what I was seeing, even though I'm not on hallucinogens, and I saw what I saw. So, loyal listeners, if you're ever in a theater and it doesn't look bright enough, look up at the projection booth. And if you're seeing two rectangles, one on top of the other, chances are there's this phenomenon that Roger Ebert has already detailed.
So this is just another reason why 3D ruins everything and is the worst. Because
yeah,
now
even
it
if
ruins
choose,
the 2D movies.
Even if you choose 2D, right. Oh, no, no, no.
And they didn't even show Flight in 3D, and yet 3D has ruined Flight.
The first 10 minutes of Flight would be something in 3D.
They would. They surely would. Let's talk about some underrated movies this year. This is the part that I enjoy, because we get to be positive.
Yes, for once.
About movies that...
And about ourselves and about, our self-esteem.
Well, I'm rarely positive about myself.
Our sexual prowess.
These are movies that, you know, will not be probably on our top 10 lists.
No,
but deserve attention.
I see us hurtling towards an obvious destination tonight. And I
death.
Think, not tonight.
That does. Oh, I don't know what you had planned. I'm sorry. I
want to live. Not like you, Patrick Bromley. That sometimes it's sort of amazing to see what is popular and what isn't popular. And I don't think my tastes has ever matched the mainstream or anything. But these are movies, I think, that were criminally underrated when they were first shown in movie theaters this year. And if you haven't seen them, I would suggest you seek them out, if only to prove me wrong.
All right, what's the first one?
Send Me a Bill. I think I might have laughed more during this film than any other film this year.
Does this film have a Spanish title?
Why, yes, it does. And
the correct answer? Si.
Si, senor. It's Casa de mi Padre,
yes.
And I talked about this in February, and how much I liked it, and as the year went on, it became my Book of Eli effect movie for comedies, because say what you want, it's trying to do something different, and I thought it was really funny.
Yeah.
With a couple exceptions, the conceit that this is a very low-budget film was very entertaining.
I still have not seen it. It is available on Netflix Instant, I know, so
oh.
I do want to see it. And I have to give credit to Will Ferrell, who's, you know, still a pretty big comedy star and is doing something kind of experimental. And, of course, it didn't pay off financially for him.
And it was so delightful to see him not playing sports
right.
in a movie. Or perhaps they just announced that Anchorman 3 got the green light.
Anchorman 2.
Oh, I'm prognosticating
again. Looking into the future,
again.
You've already
this
seen
it. This is 2017.
Too.
I personally think Anchorman is pretty funny.
Yeah.
There's a lot of funny
it's
jokes.
It's really
in it.
Funny in 10-minute segments.
Well, very much. And yes, that's a good way to put it. But I would never argue that we need a sequel. And you know what the sequel is going to be.
More of the same?
That
we had this beat. Let's do that beat again.
Right.
We had this beat.
Paul Rudd is going to get a different cologne.
Right.
That
right.
smells worse.
It's the Hangover 2.
There'll be another 70s song that they sing a cappella.
Right.
My question, though, is are they going to bring Christina Applegate back?
As far as I know, yes.
Okay, because the press release I read said, hey, we got all the guys,
oh.
and didn't mention her at all. Because when that came out, Steve Carell was not...
No, he was not yet Steve Carell.
Yeah, that sort of
yeah.
got him some attention.
Yeah. There was a rumor that they were going to be adding songs, like it would be kind of a musical, which I'm on board for. But we'll see if that ends up happening.
But Casa de mi Padre was a hoot, and you don't have to watch it on Netflix, my friend. I will loan you the Blu-ray.
Thank you.
Then you can see the bonus features.
My choice for my first underrated movie is Hit and Run, written, directed by, and starring Dax Shepard. It came out at the very last weekend of summer. Very few people saw it.
It was this
nobody
year,
liked
Piranha
it.
3D.
Kind of, yeah. Nobody liked it. I thought it was exactly what it wanted to be. It's obvious that Dax Shepard is a big fan of sort of 1970s drive-in movies. And that's what he made. It's not the best car movie ever made. In fact, a lot of the driving sort of amounts to, like, cool cars chasing each other around literally in a parking lot, because it was very low budget. So it doesn't have the best driving stunts you'll see in a car movie. For that, you have to watch Death Proof. But as somebody who's a fan of sort of movies like Grand Theft Auto or whatever, I thought it was a lot of fun. Again, sometimes these underrated choices can be a little controversial.
And when you originally talked about it, it made me want to see it,
yeah.
and then I went out and didn't see it. So shame on me.
That's all right.
I don't know if this is on your official list, but my next underrated film of 2012 is Magic Mike.
Okay.
A film that I only went to see because you were like, no, it's not what you think. And I was expecting, what all the women in the theater were expecting, that it was going to be this Hollywood marketing triumph. Let's get bachelorette parties to go to a movie. We can make money that way. And it wasn't that at all. It was this sort of homage to character-driven 70s films. I mean, really explicitly, given the type of main credits and main titles right. and stuff. Amazing performances, I thought. I thought Matthew McConaughey did a really good job of playing with the stereotype that he's become, the all right guy.
Yeah.
But also sort of going beyond it or acknowledging it, I thought the extent that he did strip routines was sort of fearless.
Yeah.
For a man his age. You're a much bigger fan of Channing Tatum than I am. One of the things I like most about it is Kevin Nash is in it as this obvious wrestler or football player or sports hero that can no longer play the sport, and he's been reduced to stripping. And in this little club, whenever all the male strippers do these dance routines, he's in the back, and he can't do it at all. I thought that was a really nice, subtle joke.
I'm a big fan of the movie, and that, you know, Steven Soderbergh is he's just a really good director. I rewatched it a couple weeks ago, and I think it delivers a little bit more on sort of the big naked guy party than I remembered. Because as I was watching it, when I first saw it, I thought, well, this is a movie that won't get the audience that it should get because they're staying away thinking it's male strippers. And then the women who are coming out to it are being disappointed because it's sort of this thoughtful character thing. As I watched it, it felt like it straddled that line better than I remembered, that it had enough of the thing to serve the one audience but was still this other really good movie.
And I can still remember when I saw it in the theater, and there is quite a lot of stripping in, like, the first 12 minutes.
Yeah.
And then there isn't a lot of stripping for a really long time. So if you do a running time thing, there was X amount of stripping for X, you would reach the conclusion that you reach. But the audience that I saw it with turned.
Yeah.
And I believe there were walkouts.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's very frustrating because people missed a good movie. I just watched Killer Joe, which isn't on my list, but it's good and worth seeing. And Matthew McConaughey this year made Killer Joe and Bernie and Magic Mike. And he's a supporting player in all of them. And they all sort of call upon his very specific Texas persona, that kind of drawl. But he uses them all to such good effect that we've had this conversation about other actors before. Maybe this is the year that Matthew McConaughey figured out that he shouldn't be a leading man, that he's a really good character actor, because he's really great in these three character parts, and I don't think I've ever seen him as a leading man be good. I mean, the other thing that he's best in is Dazed and Confused, where once again he's playing a character part.
I would agree, and I think we've had this conversation before about Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
And I think we need to have this conversation about Leslie Mann.
Yeah.
Who, when I've seen her in small parts,
right.
she's very good and very funny, but well, I don't think she could carry a film.
Again, this goes back to Knocked Up. Hey, when they're this part of the movie, they're interesting and really good, mm-hmm. and then you give them their own movie, and it's not the case.
It's like that Patton Oswalt routine about the Star Wars prequels. Really? You want to see Darth Vader as a little boy? Oh, that might be cool. No, he's actually kind of sad. That going back to Matthew McConaughey, he has a film coming out next year. He has a film coming out in 2013 where he's losing all this weight to play an AIDS patient.
Yeah.
We'll see how that works out.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, should I?
Next. I have another one, right?
Yeah. Because you're next, but then I want to open a can of worms.
Okay, cool. Another controversial choice, one that will not win me any fans, but that's what I'm all about on this show. A movie I saw last January that no one liked and that I still kind of like, which is Man on a Ledge, the Sam Worthington movie where he plays a man on a ledge. There's more to it than that. It's sort of a heist movie. Listen, everyone. It's not a great movie at all, but it knows exactly what it is. It's sort of this fun, ridiculous, tight little pseudo-action con movie. Ridiculously overqualified cast for the movie. Elizabeth Banks is actually really great and worth seeing just for her. She plays a police officer. The movie's worth seeing just for her performance. I don't know. I think the movie knows exactly how silly it is. doesn't shy away from that, and I was really entertained by it.
You preface that by saying, listen, listen, which made me laugh, because when my wife and I do our impression of an inebriated person who corners you, that's how we always begin it.
Okay.
Listen, listen.
I'm drunk right now, if that helps.
I wanted to talk to you about that after the podcast. That originally comes from the group and terp I did of Plan 9, where whenever we had Kathy Wood speaking, she was like drunk in a bar telling you stories. Listen, listen. Those two words, and then you randomly insert, you don't know me. So here's the can of worms, and it's time to open it up.
All right.
And it just shows the vagaries of fortune, or the there's no accounting for taste. John Carter, which we've discussed before.
Yes.
I thought was criminally underrated.
Yes.
And I went to see it expecting something really awful and enjoyed it quite a bit. Mm-hmm. I'm not claiming it's great, but I thought it was good. And it did a lot of things I had not seen in a film before. And I've said this before, it was a rousing boys' adventure story. It did the Joseph Campbell cycle nicely. And that woman... I'm sorry, I'm a man, and she's one of the most attractive women I've seen in 20 years. So John Carter comes out, and it's almost dead on arrival before it's released, because the film has a stink on it. And then, later in the year, I go see The Hobbit. And I'm not expecting to like it, because I'm not a fan of the Lord of the Rings films, but I went to see The Hobbit, and I liked it. It was enjoyable. It was a rousing boy's adventure story. It did the Joseph Campbell thing well. And I'm just sitting here with John Carter in my left hand and The Hobbit in my right hand, and I can't figure it out. Because The Hobbit's been the number one movie in America for the third week in a row. I think just in the United States it's made $100 million in 3 weeks, about $33 million a week.
It's made over $200 million.
Okay, because the first week it like made 47 or something.
Yeah, it just cleared 200 this weekend.
So... is it all hype? Is it the fact that it's based on a book? Is it the fact that a movie can get a stink? I'd like to think I'm objective, mostly because I went into both movies expecting nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're pretty much the same in terms of entertainment value.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it has to do with expectations, because I did finally see The Hobbit. I think I liked it I liked it less than you, I think. I might have even liked it less than John Carter. But again, maybe that's because I am a fan of the Lord of the Rings movies, and since it's not that, I'm holding it to an unfair standard. I deliberately didn't put John Carter on my list because I knew that you would, and we've been sort of talking about it all year. It's very strange because more than one critic has put it on the worst of list. These are like, you know, quote-unquote legitimate published critics.
In some magazines, it's the worst. And I can only think... you only saw 5 movies this year?
There's this weird thing that sets in, and I don't want to turn this into just a blast, because all of this stuff is obviously completely subjective, and if you don't like something or if you like something, whatever. So, and I like to believe that people are honest about their own tastes, but I think sometimes this weird sort of hive mindset takes place in the critical community where John Carter, to call John Carter the worst movie of the year, is very, very easy, because... even if you didn't see John Carter, and there's a good chance you didn't, you're sort of aware that it's supposed to be bad. You're aware that it bombed. And so as a critic, if I'm putting it out there, this is the worst movie, no one's going to question me. Because even those who didn't see it will say, like, oh, right, that's the worst movie. And so it just becomes a very, a sort of a safe answer. And again, maybe these people saw John Carter, maybe they genuinely think no worse movie came out in 2012. I have a hard time believing that.
Because maybe these people saw John Carter and didn't see Dark Shadows.
We'll get to Dark Shadows.
That's true.
I liked John Carter. I think it was very underrated, and perhaps we'll discover an audience on video, although it's been out for a while. I say video. It just has started showing up on cable. Maybe people will start to watch it and like it. I don't know. It's unfortunate that movie...
I would actually go to see a sequel of John Carter.
As would I.
And obviously they have the source material because there's all these books.
Right.
It's just sad.
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, speaking of John Carter, an unnamed relative at Christmas dinner I have some relatives who have the opposite taste.
I think we've talked about this before.
Have we talked about it on the podcast?
I think that they liked Grown-Ups, maybe.
That everything I hate, they love, and everything I love, they hate.
Yeah.
It came up that someone was recommending a movie, and someone else said, I heard it was bad. And then the relative in question, who shall be unnamed, said, it couldn't be as bad as the worst movie I've ever seen. Pause. Sucker Punch.
Well, yeah, there you go.
And I only saw that because of your podcast.
Yeah.
And I believe it was on my 10 best list for the year.
It was, in fact.
Of, I think we're just going to rename the podcast Ambitious Failure. Because I know that describes me.
It describes me minus the ambition. My next choice for an underrated movie. Oh, this is, all right, whatever. I'll call this underrated, even though I think it was kind of critically acclaimed. And that's Haywire, which also came out last January. Steven Soderbergh's other movie from this year. Came out in January. Critics, for the most part, liked it. Wasn't a big hit. Most of the audience members that I spoke to that have seen it were not fans.
No.
And again, I think that has to do with expectation. We certainly on this podcast are guilty of building up expectations for Haywire, because last year on the Best Of Show, we were talking about how it was definitely going to be the best movie of the year.
The year of Haywire. Yeah. And you and Doug made such a big deal about
it. We were very excited about it.
That even though I liked it, your hype, there's no way the film lived up to your hype.
Of course not. And I don't think, you know, people were disappointed just in relation to our hype, but I thought the trailers did a great job of selling a movie that looked super kick-ass. And the movie isn't that exactly. It's sort of this other thing, and I think when people realized it was this other thing, they kind of wrote it off. But I think it's really good. I think it's really good at being the thing that it is, not the thing that we were all hoping it would be.
And something I've noticed, and it certainly isn't unique to this year, but more and more, the marketing department gets a film that is difficult to market, and so through their trailer, they create a film that's easier to market, and I could see people going to the actual film and being disappointed. Jack Reacher is being sold as X. It really isn't X almost at all.
Okay.
It's very, very different. And there. Oh, and Flight, I felt, was mis-sold as this is intriguing and thought-provoking. And maybe it was just a trailer for the first hour of the film.
Flight had one of my favorite trailers of the year. I mean, that trailer was really good.
Yeah.
The movie I liked less.
I did. But again, as I said before we started the podcast, there's so many movies that if you were to just take a scissors to them, you could make them much better. My next underrated film, and boy, I wish I could recreate the audience I saw this with, was Killing Them Softly.
Ah, yes.
Which I liked a lot. I felt you could tell that things had been cut out of it, because for a film of that length, the pacing of the individual scenes didn't seem to be the pacing of individual scenes in a 90-minute movie.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I guess there's another hour somewhere, and I'd like to see that.
Yeah, me too.
James Gandolfini comes off best. I mean, if there's any justice, he would get a Academy Award nomination for Best Supporting Actor. That's never going to happen in our lifetime.
Nope.
The cut that we have, the cut that I saw, I think suffers because they left all the political stuff in.
Yeah.
Everywhere we go in this gangster's paradise, there's a radio or a TV showing us CNN clips from the financial crisis of 2008. And I think in a longer cut, that might have worked better. But I saw this with an audience of middle-aged people who were there to see a nice crime movie with Brad Pitt, and man, did they hate it.
Yeah.
There were walkouts. One of my colleagues at school happened to be there with his wife and son, and much later, because he actually didn't see me in the theater, much later I talked to him about what he thought, and he just hated the film. He thought it was pointless. He thought it was too dark.
Which, by the way, is whatever. We don't need to get into that. That is a very common critique of a movie, usually from younger people. When they don't like something, it's pointless. But that critique makes no sense to me.
Well, especially because movies that are very popular, year in and year out, I would argue are actually pointless, in that this was only made to sort of be cotton candy for the summer. That it's
sure, but it's then the point is to entertain. I just don't think pointless is a valid criticism of the movie.
But no, I agree.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think there's a lot to like in the movie. It doesn't totally come together, as you talked about after you had seen it. It's interesting, too, that two scenes really get singled out in that movie, and I won't spoil necessarily the context of the scenes. One is there's a shooting through the windows of a car, mm-hmm. and it's shot very beautifully. And I actually had some problems with that scene because it just felt a little too self-indulgent and a little too sort of messed with through computers. The other scene that gets talked about a lot, which is a great scene and almost worth seeing the movie just for the scene, is that first sort of heist at the card game.
Oh, yeah.
Man, is it great. Really suspenseful and really well done.
And maybe one of the things that these people who saw it and didn't like about it might have been that the film set such a high bar in the heist that there's no way that it can top that. So it just sort of seems to dwindle to a close. But again, I'm hoping that the DVD will be an extended cut. That
yeah, me too. Nice. I kind of doubt it. We talk a lot, too, about endings, especially in the last few days. You and I have talked about endings to movies and how they are both the easiest and the hardest thing to get right. And I think part of the reaction to that movie, because we talked about this maybe not on the podcast, but there's this ridiculous thing called cinema score that a lot of people put value in, and I do not. But the cinema score rating, supposedly, is like sort of this exit polling for movies, and Nikki Fink every week reports, hey, this movie has an A with cinema score, which is meaningless, because almost everything gets an A or B. Killing Them Softly is one of, I think, only seven movies since the invention of cinema score to
since
get
the dawn of time
to get an F.
Yeah,
and I don't remember what all the others were, but I know one of the others was the remake of Solaris that Steven Soderbergh did with George Clooney, which again is a really good movie, which leads me to believe that cinema score is worthless. It got an F. I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that the last scene in the movie is a very bitter pill, and people walk out feeling angry and cheated and like someone just told them to fuck off, which someone basically did.
Right. Given the national mood, the Brad Pitt character expresses some feelings that even though we're 4 years out from the financial crisis of 2008, it's so bitter and it's so cynical about the so-called American dream that people sort of reject it.
Just the way that it's even cut together. It's very harsh. It's very abrupt.
Oh, yeah.
And I think people felt cheated when it ended.
But again, a thoughtful person, because when I first saw it, my reaction was, that was abrupt.
Mm-hmm.
With the passage of time, I liked the ending mm-hmm. more and more.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't anyone in that theater who maybe, or anyone who gave it this bad cinema score, didn't anyone think, well, you know it's the bad guy talking.
Right.
And maybe that's part of the point the film is trying to make.
Right.
It's certainly worth your time.
Definitely. My next movie is a movie that almost made my top 10 list, honestly. It was sort of off and on, but it will not be on my top 10 list. And that is a movie called Universal Soldier Day of Reckoning, which is almost a direct-to-DVD action movie. Either the fourth or the sixth movie in the Universal Soldier series, directed by John Hyams, son
of Peter.
You
reviewed this for Heavy Action, right?
I did,
okay.
Yeah. I'm a fan of action movies, and it's amazing how little sort of experimentation actually happens within that genre. Action movies are sort of always the same thing. And it was very refreshing to see something that was very willing to be something totally different. And in a year that we didn't get a movie from Gaspar Noé or David Lynch, we had Universal Soldier Day of Reckoning, which owes a lot to those two filmmakers. And I think it's really interesting, even if you're not a fan of action movies, I think it's worth checking out because it's one of those movies that you can't believe got made.
I've had that experience before. And proof that Patrick's choices are truly underrated, because we didn't talk about this before we started. I have not seen one of your underrated choices. Well, I feel the fool.
That's all right.
My next underrated film was Seven Psychopaths.
Okay.
Which I thought deserved a bigger release, or maybe to hang on a little bit longer. I'm not claiming it's the greatest film ever made, and I have to admit I have not yet seen In Bruges.
Oh.
Because everyone I talk to dismisses Seven Psychopaths by saying, well, it's no In Bruges.
Yeah. Those people are right.
But I really liked a lot of Seven Psychopaths. I thought it was very entertaining, especially the Sam Rockwell performance, and here's yet another example that he's never given a bad performance. I really thought that Christopher Walken was trying a little bit to not do that thing.
Right.
In much the same way that Robert De Niro actually turned in a performance this year. So pleasant to have you back, Robert, because you were a national treasure who spent 10 years making fun of yourself for no apparent reason.
Right.
That Robert De Niro's performance in Silver Linings Playbook is really, really good. It's one of the best things about the film. But I thought Seven Psychopaths was interesting, and I liked the twisty plot, and I liked a majority of the performances, and I don't understand why it didn't get more attention.
I agree. I think there's a lot of things to like in it, a lot of good performances. I really liked Woody Harrelson. A lot of good writing, which is not a surprise from Martin McDonagh. And definitely tries to sort of deconstruct this sort of crime genre. A movie like Killing Them Softly, it's sort of deconstructing that. I think the movie, from its champions, is a little overrated. I think they're giving a little bit too much credit for doing some things that I think have been done since the 90s. Mm-hmm. But I thought it was, I was definitely entertained, and I liked, like you said, that it's trying to do something when so few movies actually do.
In a weird way, you could sort of see Killing Them Softly and Seven Psychopaths as the very end of the let's imitate Tarantino cycle. Mm-hmm. And it's odd, because all these movies were imitating Reservoir Dogs. Mm-hmm. Tarantino's moved on to much different pastures, but we still keep wringing that rag dry.
My fifth and final underrated movie, for me, aside from John Carter, maybe the most underrated movie of the year, and again, this will not win me any new friends, is a movie that I've talked about before, Snow White and the Huntsman, which came out in the summer, made a bunch of money, so it's not that people didn't go see it, but I don't know that a lot of people that saw it particularly liked it. It got kind of caught up in the, well, here's Kristen Stewart doing something that's not Twilight, then it got kind of caught up in the Kristen Stewart was banging the director, will she be back for a sequel, and people were talking about all these things besides the movie, and there's a lot of people that didn't like the movie, and I get it, but like Sucker Punch, I think the movie is about way more than what it seems to be about on the surface. I think it's more than just because, man, are we getting a lot of...
Oh my lord.
We're getting the new...
What started
Jack
this?
And the Beanstalk, and we're getting the new Hansel and Gretel, and there's a new Sleeping Beauty in the works, and there's possibly a new Cinderella, and it's like, these aren't your parents' fairy tales, pussy, and... but I really do think that Snow White and the Huntsman is more than that. And on top of that, it's very, very beautiful. The photography is very stunning. I think people should give it a chance.
And you've completed the hat trick plus two. I have seen none. Oh, wait, I take that back. Saw Haywire.
Oh, yeah, you did.
I have not seen four out of your five.
All right.
So now, laboriously, we turn the wheel of time to films that we thought were overrated, perhaps.
This one is less fun, because it's a lot of fun to say, hey, everybody, this movie that you didn't see or maybe didn't like, give it a second look. This is a good movie, and we like talking about good movies. It's a little harder to say, this thing that you liked, you shouldn't, which I don't...
Well, we do that all the time.
I know, not on the podcast. So
wasn't there a time when I got into a lot of trouble because I was frequently telling people, it's okay for you to like that.
Yes. You didn't really get in trouble.
Well, they found that condescending.
Yeah, well, it is condescending. Because
I didn't mean I'm giving you permission to like it.
But that's what it sounds like.
So I've amended it to, it's really good that you like it.
That's also condescending.
Okay. I'm so glad you found a film that you like.
That's okay. I think that's okay.
At least you liked it.
And so the thing about...
It wasn't a complete loss for the both of us for the evening.
The majority of my movies that I chose as overrated, I don't even necessarily think are bad. Because I think there are things to like in several of them. And this year has been so weird that now every movie is polarizing. So it's actually hard to find a movie that's overrated. Because for everything that I'm saying is overrated... Half the audience agreed with me. Half the people didn't like it, and then another half really liked it. So I'm with the 51%, I guess.
Why don't you start?
Okay. For my first overrated movie, Silver Linings Playbook.
Which is on my list of overrated films as well.
Not a movie I totally disliked. In fact, while it was on, I was having an okay time. I think there's some good performances. You just mentioned Robert De Niro. A lot of people seem to think Jennifer Lawrence is a lock for a Best Actress nomination, if not a win.
I thought she was really, really good. She's and carried really the film. Good. And again, I'm glad that Bradley Cooper is successful, but I find him an actor of limited range.
Sure.
And I don't know what he was doing in this film.
I didn't have as big a problem with him, because I did feel like he was trying to do something different. And I, for the most part, bought him in the movie. I really want to write a really long article about Silver Linings Playbook. The movie hasn't quite caught on in the public consciousness enough for that to be worthwhile, because enough people haven't seen it.
Well, then let me just spoil what would be your main point.
No, I don't think you should.
Because after the film, you said something that, okay, I'll...
And I haven't seen this point
now
made...
Now we're teasing.
That's fine. Okay. I haven't, if the movie... Make the movie a big hit, and then I'll write the article, everyone.
Okay, Patrick will write the article, because this has Oscar bait all over it, and it's going to get some nominations.
And if that does happen, then I will, because I think more people need to see it first. But for the movie to have worked for me, it needed to go in a different direction.
Patrick has some very interesting things to say about Silver Linings Playbook, and I won't spoil them.
Yes.
Because they're his thoughts.
Thank you.
My first overrated film I thought was such a mess that it made me go back and reassess other films the director had made.
I've done that before. It happens all the time.
Oh, so there's this. And obviously this thing is so polarizing that maybe I shouldn't even have an opinion, but I went to Dark Knight Rises with great expectations.
Yeah.
And I think Dark Knight Rises is a mess.
It is.
I think it's the dictionary definition of a movie that's a mess for any number of reasons. And I think one of them is, and I used to call this Spielberg syndrome, because if you go see AI, which is a movie with an idea in its head, you will notice that AI ends four separate times because Spielberg is so famous and so brilliant that no one will second guess him, and no one will criticize him and say, hey, no, or he doesn't listen to it and he doesn't have to, he's Steven Spielberg. That we now see Spielberg syndrome in Judd Apatow, who needs to listen to people who have his best interest in mind, and I think the same can be said of Christopher Nolan. After the tremendous success of The Dark Knight, he could have done anything, and he did, and it's not good.
No, he made Inception afterwards, actually. So
I take that back, because I'm a big fan of Inception.
Yeah.
But Dark Knight Rises made me go back and look, because I was not a fan of Batman Begins.
Okay.
Almost not at all. I saw it, and I said, I get it. They want to make it a little bit more realistic, because people today don't want their fantasy films to be fantastical. They want to pretend that it could really happen. So he's got a tank. Okay, I get it. And I really didn't like it. Although it was nice to see the Scarecrow in a movie, because the Scarecrow has always been one of my favorite Batman villains. But I was such a fan of The Dark Knight, because I think that film is about so many things. I've made this point over and over, that the really good comic book movies are both comic book movies and about something very different and about something much bigger and something greater. And I really think The Dark Knight accomplished that. And not subtly. It's very explicit about what it's talking about, and I gave it credit for that. But Dark Knight Rises is such a mess, it made me think that Dark Knight was a happy accident, or that I'm focusing on two things. The Heath Ledger performance, and the fact that it seems to be saying some thoughtful things about the nature of terrorism.
But those are two pretty significant things missing from The Dark Knight Rises. And again, that's almost the movie that I was referring to in terms of movies being polarizing this year. Because you have half the audience saying, I don't really care for Dark Knight Rises. And half the audience saying, it's the second coming. It's the best of the trilogy, blah, blah, blah. We did a whole podcast on Dark Knight Rises, so I won't get into my specific issues with the movie. But I, like you, find it to be a tremendous mess and a disappointment from a director that I really like. And in a lot of ways, it's interesting that you bring this up, the comparison to Batman Begins, because in almost every way, The Dark Knight Rises is only a sequel to Batman Begins. It almost acts as if The Dark Knight never happened. There's a few plot things, but in terms of thematically, in terms of where the story goes, it pretty much ignores The Dark Knight.
Yeah.
And that's, a lot of us couldn't get over that heartbreak, because where The Dark Knight sets us up, he's riding off into the night to be the bad guy. Oh, man, I can't wait to see where this goes. And then it goes in a bad direction. And it's a mess. And some people, including, I think, film critic Hulk, have floated this idea that the Joker and Heath Ledger were supposed to be sort of an integral part of the third movie. And when he died, Christopher Nolan's not only had to sort of rejigger what the movie was going to be, but his heart was no longer in it. And I do kind of feel that with The Dark Knight Rises. It doesn't seem like a movie that his heart is in.
I can believe that. My son just came down here to very quietly grab a Blu-ray off the shelf.
Very quietly.
And I tried to get his attention. My son does the greatest Bane impression. I was going to ask him to do his Bane impression. But part of his Bane impression is a critique of some of the things that Bane says during that first sequence.
Sure.
Because they don't make any sense.
Right.
It's both of our losses, okay, that he has stolen away like a thief in the night.
So, again, it's an overrated movie only as far as its champions are concerned, because lots of people didn't like it.
But it made a lot of money.
It did,
because you have to go see it, because it's like you have to buy the set.
Right, exactly.
Well, I've invested 4 hours.
My next overrated movie, again, I take no pleasure in calling this an overrated movie, The Perks of Being a Wallflower, which has popped up on a whole bunch of 10 best lists,
wow,
including from some writers that I really like and respect, have named it one of the 10 best movies of the year. There's a lot to like in it. The performances are good. It's well directed. It has good music. Some of the writing is good. Its heart is definitely in the right place. There's a supporting performance by an actor named Ezra Miller, who was in We Need to Talk About Kevin. His performance in the movie is great, and if he got an Oscar nomination, I would say I'm okay with that. I just think, ultimately, it's a big mess, and it wants to be this very sort of universal, it wants to have some universal truths about what it's like to be young and misunderstood and feel out of place, and some of that it does very well, but then it makes some very specific choices that come from the book, and I don't remember the author's name, but this author adapted his own book, and I believe directed the movie himself, which rarely works out. Authors directing, we've all seen Maximum Overdrive, but he does a good job. But there's some very specific choices made in the text that, to me, diminish the universality of it. I was disappointed in the end because I thought it ended up a big mess. Again, not a bad movie, just, to me, kind of a misguided one, and I only say it's overrated because it's gotten on all these 10 best lists, and I don't think it's one of the best movies of the year.
And I think I avoided it, because I just assumed, given the rating it went out with, that he had watered down his book. Now, I may be wrong, but what I'm going by is, many years ago in my school district, a wrong-headed school board member tried to ban 7 books from the classroom. And this is seldom a good idea. And the list was bizarre in its crazy randomness. And
Archie,
of course,
number 535.
And like most people who devote their time to this, she proudly proclaimed that she had not read any of the books, that she had relied on this website that only contains the objectionable material. So next to a work of literary genius like Slaughterhouse-Five, it would just be a list of swear words, which would make you think, well, why would anyone give that to a child? It's a list of swear words. So Perks of Being a Wallflower was on the list, along with How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accent, and Freakonomics, and The Awakening, which I had taught, and Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, of course.
Of course.
And Slaughterhouse-Five. I forget the other two titles. But I just assumed that because it made the list, it was this hotbed of, I don't know, teenage sexuality or something.
Yeah.
And that I assumed that the movie version had watered it down. Because surely any book on a list of banned books would have to at least be rated R.
I have not read the book, so I can't speak to how accurate it is, although the fact that the author is adapting his own stuff suggests to me that it's pretty faithful. I certainly didn't see anything in the movie that would make me want to ban a book version of it, but whatever.
My next overrated film, and I'm guessing that no one in our listening audience has seen this film, and I'm saying good to that, because I went to the very uncomfortable art screen. Patrick, I think, knows the theater I'm talking about.
I surely did.
And I think it was in the middle of the year. I remember it was raining that night. And I saw The Intouchables.
Ah, yes.
And the audience I saw it with loved it because it was giving everything they wanted in a movie. And it's a French film about a very rich man who's a quadriplegic, and he hires a down-on-his-luck black man to sort of be his Man Friday assistant. Really creepy nurse, because if you're quadriplegic, the nurse has to do some things that most of us wouldn't want to think about. And for a while, I was giving it some credit for sort of avoiding some cliches, but in the end, it was just this horrible masterpiece theater tapioca version that was designed to make us feel good and to not challenge us with anything.
Right.
And, of course, at the end, we had the filmmakers briefly show us the real people the story was based on, and apparently the manservant in reality wasn't black.
Yikes.
He was a different ethnicity that they didn't think would be cool enough,
right,
or provide enough of a contrast or something. Just dreadful, especially when you consider what the film could have been about.
Right, right. My next choice is Take This Waltz, directed by Sarah Polley. Again, not a terrible movie, just a movie that I feel like a lot of people praised, some of it for good reason. The photography is very beautiful.
Sarah Silverman fans had a lot to say about the film.
Michelle Williams is always good, although I always find myself uninterested in her as an actress.
But I thought just now you were going to say Michelle Williams is always nude.
She is always nude. Films. She is, and in this one. So there's a lot of things to like about the movie, and I think it's trying to say some things about relationships that isn't often said in movies. So I give it credit for all these things. But I also think it has some crippling problems.
We briefly talked about this earlier in the year, and I made a big deal out of the fact that she falls in love with this guy who pulls a rickshaw, because that's a thing. But with the benefit of hindsight, I've thought a lot about the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And you had said this before, and I recently saw The Guilt Trip. Seth Rogen is a treasure.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, someone suggested in their review of This Is 40 that Apatow needs to get back together with Rogen, excuse me, because Rogen is effortlessly charming and he gets us on his side. And the critic that I read said his problem with This Is 40 is that every character was unlikable.
Yeah.
So we need a Seth Rogen. Seth Rogen was very good in The Guilt Trip, and he's very, very good in Take This Waltz, doing something a little bit different,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
And as countless critics have pointed out, there's a scene in an indoor amusement park,
yes,
where Michelle Williams and her new love ride a tilt-a-whirl to Video Killed the Radio Star, and that's something.
Yeah.
I like that scene a lot.
Yeah. Again, the last sort of half hour of the movie attempt to pull the previous 90 minutes into focus and almost do it. I just had a lot of issues with the first 90 minutes.
I also got the feeling that the Sarah Silverman subplot had been reduced.
Yeah.
Because there's a scene where they bring her back and she's a recovering alcoholic and she's had a relapse and she's been driving drunk and no one knows where she was and she has chicks in the car for her kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that scene was so weird and so unsettling and so specific that I really liked that scene.
Mm-hmm.
But again, what is it doing in this movie?
Right, right. Anyway, I almost think it's worth seeing. I didn't see the movie that a lot of critics saw. That's all. That's why I say it's overrated. Next for you, sir. I only have one more, so.
That's cool.
Because I had Dark Knight Rises also.
Oh, and I'll cap it at this, because we need to spend some time on the shit, the horrible shit. I had not read the book, or any of the books, and I went to see Hunger Games, and I thought it was fine.
Yes.
I thought it was entertaining. In retrospect, though, the more I think about it since I've seen it,
yes,
it really wasn't anything special. People seem to love it, much like the Harry Potter movies, although I'm not comparing them, because it did the book.
Yeah.
Here's this book
yeah.
that you liked, and now you get to see it on screen.
Yeah.
Looking back, I didn't think it was that good. I like Jennifer Lawrence.
Yeah.
I like her in almost everything she's done. But what was so great about that film?
Yeah, I don't know. I think for me, and I liked the movie, didn't love it. For me, it was the Jennifer Lawrence performance, the character, and how much it stuck with her as a character to the extent that everything in the movie is sort of filtered through her. Mm-hmm. And that was done in the book because it's a first-person narrator, and the whole thing is done in voiceover, so you're privy to all these sort of internal thoughts. And
so you've read the book.
I have, yeah.
And is the movie very faithful to
it's the pretty
book?
Faithful. There's a few changes, and honestly, I felt like the changes that they did make were smart changes because there are certain things that would not have worked. It's the giant squid in Watchmen. It's like, there's certain things you can't do in a movie and have people stay on board.
My favorite example of that is the topiary in The Shining.
Right.
Which, when I read that book, that was the first time a book had ever scared me. I mean, that really, I think I was 11. It really freaked me out. And Kubrick was smart enough to know there's no way you can do that in a movie. And then they make that foolish made-for-TV movie version, and they bring the topiary back and prove that Kubrick was right.
Right, right.
You can't have bushes running around. You just can't. Prove me wrong. Make a film called Dancing Bush.
I liked it, didn't love it. And yeah, I mean, it was obviously a phenomenon because the book is so popular, you know.
I liked it, I didn't love it.
Yeah, right. My last choice, again, another polarizing movie, and one that just came out, and that is Les Miserables, which you have people saying it's great, it deserves all the Oscars, and you have people saying it's The Emperor with No Clothes, it's not any good. And I am on the side of the latter. I think it's a pretty bad movie. I think it's not just is it, you know, not a good adaptation of the musical. Maybe it's a fine adaptation of the musical. I say this as somebody who's never seen the musical on stage. But I just think every choice made by Tom Hooper, from pretty much the casting on to the way it's shot, I will give him credit for doing the singing live on camera. It's a ballsy choice, and I think that's one of the things in the movie that works. Everything else, I thought, was pretty actively bad. And again, there's plenty of people who aren't liking it, so you may think, why are you calling this overrated? I just think come Oscar time, certain movies, again, I think it's easy to just throw a bunch of nominations at Les Mis because it's a movie with a pedigree. His last movie won an Oscar. Look at all the actors in the cast. It's based on a musical. It's this famous property. So I think it is a movie that's going to get some Oscar nominations, and I would have a problem with that.
I haven't seen it because it seems like a school assignment, and I've read so many bad reviews. I'll admit the songs are catchy. I mean, the songs are very, very catchy.
The music is not a problem.
But you were talking about the way it's filmed. I know most of Dana Stevens' review on Slate revolved around the fact that because Hooper made this choice to have them do the singing live, that the amount of close-ups in the film is absurd, and she likened it to shoving the camera down the actors' throats so you can actually see their uvulas twitch or something, that he was sort of underscoring the fact, you see, they're really singing, they're really, really singing.
I listened to one review that gave that choice a lot of credit, suggesting that rather than pull back and just film people all in the same frame, this guy kept referencing Rob Marshall, the way Rob Marshall shot Chicago, which I actually really like the way Rob Marshall shot Chicago, that it sort of brings you into the action and follows these actors around. I tend to think it's just Tom Hooper doesn't know how else to make a movie. I think this is his thing, and yeah. So he's going to do everything in that style.
I made it intimate.
Right. I don't think it's good.
I haven't seen it. I have a feeling at some point soon I will be forced to see it. And so now I raise the ceremonial little plastic toilet.
Yes.
And let's spend some time talking about the films. I have to give credit where credit is due. I once had a boss who was a delightful, very smart gentleman. And once a year, we served on the board of the school's literary magazine. And if you volunteer for this task, you have to read all the poem submissions. You have to read, let me make this clear what this is, because some of you might not know what I'm talking about. You have to read hundreds of poems and short prose pieces that were written by high school students. Do we all know what I'm talking about?
I absolutely do.
And each one of us assigns the piece a number rating, and there's five teachers and five students, and the pieces that get the highest scores go into the book. And that's the way it works. And we meet, there comes a Thursday morning where we sit down. We actually all sit down in a room and share our scores. Because if there's a piece that you feel strongly about, you're allowed to argue and make us change our minds. One year, the batch of student work was particularly thin. And we were sharing our scores and everything. And we got to a poem. And my former boss, Kurt Laxo, a very delightful man, said, after I read this poem, I was a little less alive. And I've carried that in my head. Folks, after we saw these movies in 2012, we were a little less alive. Now, are we going to go from the bottom of the toilet to the top?
I didn't rank mine in order of, like, worst to best.
And
or
now
best
I'm
to
kicking
worst.
Myself because I spent hours trying to determine which was worse, Rock of Ages or Hitchcock.
I just had a bunch of movies that I didn't think were any good.
How many do you have?
I don't even know. Seven, maybe, or eight. Okay. So I could just read through the list, or we could go back and forth, however you want to do it. Because I won't have much to say about most of the movies. It's more just...
Okay, and we don't want to...
A collection of titles of movies.
We don't want to outstay our welcome.
Yeah.
Because so far the talk has been so scintillating that I could see people listening for another 2 hours. The worst film of the year was Dark Shadows.
I would agree. I agree with that assessment.
Patrick never agrees with me.
Well, and I think it could almost come across that we're being those we're being that guy. The guy who wants to make a name for himself by calling O Brother, Where Art Thou the worst movie of the year, which Entertainment Weekly did the year that O Brother, Where Art Thou was released.
And the year that Michael Phillips named it his number one film of the year in the Chicago Tribune.
Right. So, listen, if you feel passionately about something, that's fine. So, it's like, well, Adam Sandler made a movie this year. How could Dark Shadows possibly be worse? But I just feel like... I agree. Dark Shadows was bad in ways that I haven't seen a movie be bad before.
And one of the final shitting on the classics columns was about Dark Shadows.
Yeah.
Because, again, I hold this close to my heart because I used to watch the TV show when I was a very little kid, and it was something that was very special to me. And looking back, I kind of realized that might have been my entree into the whole monster thing and that it wasn't the Universal monster films. Dark Shadows might have been the TV show Dark Shadows might have been the gateway drug to the rest of the imaginative world. But it was so great. After I wrote that column, people commented on it and said that they weren't going to see it, but the column made them want to see it, or the column kept them from seeing it. But everyone who actually went said that I nailed it.
Yeah.
Or that I didn't go far enough to describe. I mean, it's not a movie.
It's not a movie. It's almost as though they shot a bunch of scenes and then took all the scenes and threw them in the air in the editing room and then taped them together, and that's what they ran through the projector, because no scene in the movie has anything to do with what comes before or after that scene.
Right. They set things up that don't pay off. There's this ludicrous reveal at the end that's like, what? Really? That? Okay. And the real tragedy is, if you watch the first 10 minutes, that's what the movie would have been if they had played it straight and just said, let's do Dark Shadows for real. Why does everything have to have this ironic camp sensibility? Again, I've said this hundreds of times, given the success of Twilight, you can do a gothic thing straight.
Again, Tim Burton made Sleepy Hollow, and there's plenty of people who don't like Sleepy Hollow, but he kind of did that. He kind of did it straight, and Johnny Depp found a performance to play, and he took the material seriously, and I really like Sleepy Hollow.
No, I do too.
I think that movie works, and so I don't understand Dark Shadows.
And the first 10 minutes of Dark Shadows, the whole prologue on Widow's Walk, it's beautiful to look at,
right.
And it's actually the TV show. And suddenly we're on a train, and then things go horribly wrong.
And I guess
wrong.
The point of the movie is Tim Burton thinks the 70s were funny, because so much of the quote-unquote humor in the movie is just goofing on the 70s. It was really, truly abysmal. And again, I'm not the guy who wants to pick out a movie that maybe has kind of a high profile or has a pedigree to it and say, no, it's really the worst movie of the year. Just to sort of make a name for myself, but I really do believe, even in a year that That's My Boy was released, I think Dark Shadows is the worst movie of the year. I think there's a close second, and I talked about it a few weeks ago, and that is Battleship. The only reason why I don't think Battleship is as bad as Dark Shadows is Battleship has the actress/model Brooklyn Decker in it, and Dark Shadows does not.
And Brooklyn Decker...
She was Just Go With It. She's the
right.
Swimsuit and Just Go With It. I think she's very pretty. She was in Battleship, and when she was on screen, she was very pretty. Dark Shadows did not have Brooklyn Decker. Dark Shadows is a worse movie. But Battleship is crazy bad. Crazy bad. All of our overrated movies, I think, are movies that, if somebody tells me they like them... I can mostly understand it. There's things to like in each of them. Some I almost do like. I just don't quite match up with maybe the popular critical opinion. These movies, I think there's nothing to like.
Yeah. And I cleverly avoided Battleship.
Yeah.
Like the plague. My second worst film of 2012, I just saw last night.
All right. I don't think this is one of the worst movies of the year, but it's fine if you do.
Maybe I was in a bad mood because I had just seen a comedy that I liked, but I'm not even sure if This Is 40 is a comedy.
Yeah.
Parts of it seem to be a comedy.
Yeah.
Other parts of it seem to be something different.
Yeah.
I think you could use this as evidence to get Judd Apatow committed to a mental institution, because the filmmaking style... And the rhythm of the film, everything about its art direction and cinematography seem to suggest that he's portraying the real world. And it's not.
Sure.
It's someone's dream of the way the world works, or more specifically, someone who's so rich, this is what they imagine financial problems look like.
Yeah.
And that's just scratching the surface. You've done a whole podcast on it. You put your finger on what was wrong with the film. It also felt like it was 4 hours long.
Well, and it's interesting, too, I'm just putting this together now, that like it suffers from some of the same problems as Bridesmaids, which Apatow produced but didn't direct. And Bridesmaids, we've talked before about how it's this really interesting movie, and then it keeps getting interrupted by this wacky, gross-out comedy, right? And I think the comedy bits and the interesting, more dramatic bits in Bridesmaids both work better than either do in This Is 40. But This Is 40... will be sort of this family drama, and then every 10 minutes or so, Apatow says, like, oh, right, I'm the comedy guy, and he just inserts this scene that's not usually very funny, but it's meant to be comedic, whether it fits into the movie or not.
And This Is 40, it's the hemorrhoid scene. And I remember when Bridesmaids came out, you very astutely said, the best scene in the entire film is a scene where Kristen Wiig makes herself a cupcake. And it's amazing. But people went to see it because that's the movie where ladies shit in the sink.
Right.
Oh my God. I wonder why our country's in trouble.
I don't think This Is 40 is one of the worst movies of the year, but I think it's a mess.
It is. Perhaps you'll agree with my next choice.
I probably will.
I'm going out of turn. You go
next. No. Go ahead. Because, again, I just have a list of movies that no one should see.
Because
I could read them
enough,
all.
Three of the things on my list suffer from the same problem. The film seems to be portraying reality, but this must be on another planet. Friends with Kids.
Okay.
Was just breathtaking in its awfulness, its lack of real comedy, and its inability to say anything about anything.
I agree with you that it's not funny. I agree with you that it has mixed to non-existent messages. I thought it was a very smug movie.
Yes.
And that it subverts the thing that it's trying to say for most of its running. For most of its running time, it's applauding these characters for being unconventional and suggesting that, hey, this can really work. And then, not to spoil anything, in the end, it basically says, like, no. We succumb to convention. That's the way to be.
So the film undercuts its own hipness.
Yes.
It's hoisted by its own guitar.
Yes. However, Friends with Benefits, again, at least offered five actors that I'm willing to watch in a movie. So I can't... I'm going to read my list, because somehow I saw these movies this year.
Okay, I had a problem with Friends with Kids.
Yeah, no, I do too.
I just wanted to add, because I know this is a trope that you really hate. The billiest trope of the married couple that hate each other.
Yeah, that's very popular. That's This Is 40 also.
I've really had it with that.
I mean, we're surrounded by plenty of married couples that actually really love and like one another.
The married couples that I know that hate each other,
yeah,
they get divorced.
Yeah.
But that's never a movie.
No, it's not funny enough, I guess.
Go ahead.
So these are the movies that I saw.
He keeps opening this thing and closing it, like, the minute I look at it.
Here's the list of the movies that I saw. One for the Money, Katherine Heigl, The Bounty Hunter.
Oh, my God.
Ghost Rider, Spirit of Vengeance, This Means War, Wrath of the Titans, The Raven, Dark Shadows Battleship, Piranha 3DD, That's My Boy, and The Watch. I saw all those movies this year, which is why I can't say This Is 40 or Friends with Kids are among the worst.
This is a good point, because except Dark Shadows, yeah, I saw none of those.
Yeah.
I avoided them like the plague.
Abysmally bad.
Here's the rest of my list.
All right.
I don't think you saw To Rome with Love.
No, I did not. The Woody Allen movie.
Don't.
Okay.
And boy, he makes bad movies for 10 years, and then he makes Midnight in Paris, and people are like, ooh, he's back! No, he's not. To Rome with Love is awful.
Okay.
In every single way. In a completely different way, we get Rock of Ages.
Which I also didn't see.
And I'm now sitting here scratching my head, why did I go see Rock of Ages?
I kind of wanted to.
I think I may have said this before on the podcast, I could see how it would be popular on stage,
yeah,
because there's musicians playing live music and there's people really singing, and like Mamma Mia, they've managed to come up with this goofy story to fit all of these 70s hair metal bands songs into. It is the worst.
Yeah.
It is the worst. A week or two ago, we did a podcast on Hitchcock. It is to be avoided at all costs.
That might have been on my list. Maybe I didn't scroll down far enough. I think that's one of the worst movies of the year.
And I was so happy because I was snookered because I saw it with a happy post-Thanksgiving crowd in Evanston who loved every minute of it. And I'm like, uh-oh. But because I saw it so early in the run, the critics have been universal,
yeah,
virtually.
Yes.
There's one online critic I read who loved it.
Well, you can find somebody who loves...
But it made me so happy as I kept reading reviews and I kept hearing from people that, oh, I'm not the only one who knows something about Hitchcock who raises the flag. This is bullshit. You just made it up.
Again, even not knowing anything about Hitchcock, I think that's a bad movie.
The Amazing Spider-Man, a film that has no reason to exist.
Yeah. Another polarizing one, though. Lots of people really like it. Lots of people call it their favorite Spider-Man.
Because it's closer to the comic book?
I wouldn't argue that it is.
You're the comic book guy.
I don't really know why they would pick it as their favorite Spider-Man. But suddenly that movie came out, and the Sam Raimi movies became worthless.
Right. And to me, sitting through the damn thing, I felt like I had seen the Sam Raimi movie and then fallen asleep and had a dream where the movie I just saw was reinterpreted in unnecessary ways for no reason. Maybe it's something I ate before I went to sleep.
Yeah.
And then there was American Reunion.
Oh, I forgot about that one. That would have been on my list. I forgot about that one.
A movie that has no reason to exist. And I believe I only saw that because I thought I was going to be on the podcast.
Oh, really?
And then I wasn't.
Sorry.
So I was crushed.
So we did a podcast on American Reunion. We did a podcast on Amazing Spider-Man. We did a podcast on Hitchcock. That's too many podcasts on the worst movies of the year.
It's true. And I wrote a column about Dark Shadows.
Yeah, that's right.
I've talked about it before, Best Exotic Marigold Hotel,
right,
which we can file in the same cabinet as The Intouchables, a film that, I give it credit, it's trying to appeal to an audience that's underserved, but it is so just bad and by the numbers. And we don't have to have 10 apiece, so I'm going to cross this one off.
Ooh, what was it? Just say
it had similar problems to the other quote-unquote romantic comedies we're talking about. I really hated Wanderlust.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not hate it. It was a big mess.
Yeah.
But there were some really big laughs in it. We laughed really hard more than once in that movie, because I saw that movie with you.
Did we?
We did. It was more early on, but we laughed really hard a couple times. And again, that doesn't mean that the movie's great, but I can't put any movie that makes me laugh at all on the worst of list.
I'm not going to downgrade the power of laughter.
Notably missing from both of our lists.
At this point, we turn to, where's my brain? Sullivan's Travels, which talks quite a bit about the power of laughter.
Yeah. Neither of us mentioned Prometheus on either list.
Well, here's the problem. It originally was all over my list.
Sure.
And then I thought, I'm just going to lay off Prometheus.
Well, the thing is, I don't think it's one of the worst movies of the year, even though I think it's pretty bad. But there's things to like in it.
I thought it was one of the worst until I saw This Is 40. This Is 40 bumped Prometheus from my list.
I think it has a terrible script, but I think it's very well made, and it's got the Michael Fassbender performance. So I couldn't put it on my worst of list. But I also couldn't put it on my overrated list, because while there are people that like it, so many people acknowledge that it's bad to a mess.
And again, I don't want to break my arm patting both of us on the back. But that's one of the things in terms of F This Movie that I'm most proud of. Patrick and I went to see it and agreed not to talk about it. And then we got together and did the podcast. And the podcast, I think, was an example of what went through everyone's head who saw the movie and then made the mistake of thinking about it afterward. Yeah. Because the more we talked about it, it just fell apart in our hands.
Yeah, it's a mess. Anyway, I do think it was a good year for movies. I know we named a bunch of movies that were bad, but I thought even some of the bad movies this year had things to like about them, like Prometheus, like Dark Knight Rises.
Not Hitchcock.
No. The movies we named at the end there's pretty much nothing to like, unless Brooklyn Decker was in any of them. Anyway, thanks everybody for listening. We'll be back next year, and next week. I actually meant to say next week, and yet they're both true.
It turns rosy next week, because Patrick's right. There was a lot to like this year. Very difficult coming up with a 10 best list.
Yeah. Anyway, hope you'll listen to our 10 best list next week. Happy 2013, everybody.
Yay!